This is Where We Live.
Many people sort of think of retirement as, you know, I'm lounging around, I'm traveling around the world or seeing grandchildren. And that may not be your retirement. It may be working a little longer. It may be bringing in a roommate or living with a relative. You've got to just think differently about your retirement if you have no savings.
That's Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist for The Washington Post, in a 2013 NPR story about the vanishing retirement savings of America. She's not alone in rethinking retirement. 75% of Americans nearing retirement age in 2010 had less than $30,000 in their retirement accounts. How can we take control of our retirement years and have enough money to enjoy them? We're going to listen to a few stories today about how we're retiring in Connecticut today. We'd like to hear yours. 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Whether you're retiring soon or you have retired, whether or not you're a younger worker trying to save. We'd also like to hear your emails, wherewelive@wnpr.org. You can tweet us at wherewelive. Coming up in just a little bit, we'll hear about MyRA, a plan by the president to try to get more people to save, and an accompanying state-run plan that is at least proposed. We'll also talk to Yale social scientist Jacob Hacker, who's long been talking about the great risk shift and whether Americans exactly have enough to save for retirement. But first, we want to bring in Tom Scanlon. He's a CPA. He's a financial advisor at Raymond James. He joins us in our studio here in Hartford. Tom, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, when you hear stories like this about people having as little as $30,000 saved and they're just about ready to retire, what do you think?
Clearly, that's discouraging. No question. You know, we've come off 2008, 2009 meltdown, economic meltdown. And that certainly inflicted a lot of pain on people's retirement and, you know, their whole economic status.
And you probably have seen a lot of people like that who were planning to retire around the time of the economic crisis, and they saw an awful lot of the value in their retirement savings go away. I assume that's a pretty large percentage of the people that you're dealing with, at least around retirement age right now.
No question. You know, 2008, 2009, the economy really went down and inflicted a lot of pain on people. Fortunately, we've had some level of a rebound both in the housing market and in the equity market subsequent to that time. So that's been a positive development.
You mentioned the housing market. This is one of the things, of course, that people expected to be retiring with. They bought a house and they watched it appreciate over time. And for years, for decades really, we thought that a house was only going to grow in value. And then a lot of that value went away. Where are people exactly getting the retirement money from right now? Is it in part their home equity? Is it in part just money they've put away in savings accounts? Where exactly are they saving this money right now?
So the whole concept of retirement has really changed through the years. If you go back to the generation above us, you know, I like to say that those folks, they had one of everything. They had one wife, they had one house, they had one job, and okay, they had two cars, but neither of those cars were leased. And so they were really very disciplined savers, and their plan was very simple. Go work for one company, collect a pension, collect your Social Security. If they were more recently retired, they were involved in a 401k plan. They had a very simple plan. Today, unless you're a federal worker or state worker or municipal worker, you're not likely going to get a pension plan. Most private employers have terminated those plans and supplemented that with a 401k plan. So you've really got to take personal ownership of your retirement plan, whether that's participating in your employer's 401k plan, at least to the extent that you can get a match, whether that's funding your own IRAs, your own Roth IRAs. It's really today, it's all about personal responsibility.
You mentioned the fact that the pensions have gone away. Obviously, that's something that most younger workers never even expect anymore. But when it comes to something like a match of a 401k plan, how many employers have gotten away from that? Are still a lot of employers trying to incentivize their workers to save by matching something?
Fair enough. I apologize. I don't have the statistics. But what I would say is during 2008, 2009, many of those matches were terminated. Okay. And you're beginning to see a thaw now, and employers are having some more confidence in their ability to look forward in an environment that we're operating in today. So you're starting to see a match come back because, in fact, you know, the unemployment rate is coming down and employers need employees, and that is really is a tool to attract and retain employees is the 401k match.
We're talking about retirement on the program. Coming up a little bit later on, we're going to be hearing about a new state possibility of a plan that might help you retire. We're also going to be talking about President Obama's new MyRA plan, find out whether or not that's something that will work for people. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266 if you have questions about saving for retirement. So do you have some formulas, Tom, for people? I mean, when they're, say, a younger worker just getting started, how much money they're supposed to save each month versus someone who's mid-career and is maybe looking at retirement 10 or 15 years down the road?
It's a difficult question to answer. What I'd say is everyone's different. But first of all, you need to start where you are today. You can't turn the clock back, okay? So you're fortunate if you're young and you're dialed into this and you're working for an employer and they offer a 401k plan and you're participating and you're getting the match, that's great. And the goal would be if you can only put away 5% of your paycheck today, make it a goal to move it to 6% next year, okay? So really begin where you are today and don't look back and try to address it going forward. How can you prepare yourself for a good retirement? And that really encompasses using all the tools that are available to you. The tax code has a lot of tools. You just have to take advantage of them. So everyone's familiar with the 401k plan because that's really a pre-tax tool that many employers offer. But also there's IRAs and Roth IRAs, which are also tremendous tools. And I realize we're mostly talking about retirement here, but the health savings account, HSA, is also another tool that can be used from an income tax perspective. So it's really a function of knowing what these tools are and then allocating your dollars that you do have, because everyone has a certain amount of money, to these tools that you think can help you get to where you, from point A to point B to where you want to go.
Of course, one of the things that happened during the 2008-2009 meltdown is not just that a lot of people who were close to retirement age lost a lot of their savings. It's that I think a lot of people got scared of risk in a way that they weren't previously. Over the course of my whole working life, I was always told, you got to put things in aggressive funds. You got to make sure you're saving money because this will grow into millions of dollars by the time you retire. But I think a lot of people looked at all this value that got spilt during 2008 and 2009 and said, let's try to make it as safe as possible. And I think that's at the heart of some of these new ideas that are coming out of the federal government is save something. It doesn't have to be at a very, very high rate. Just make sure you save. What's your formula or calculation for that? Because I think sometimes people might be saving a little too little or at too low a rate in order to actually retire where they want.
Fair question. So yeah, certainly in 2008 and 2009, for a lot of folks, risk became a four-letter word. And, that's really impacted them. But the good news, though, is for some folks in 2008, 2009, it really was a slap in the head. And they realized that we just can't continue to consume and consume and consume. And we need to slow down and figure out where we're going from here. So each person has their own risk index that they need to be comfortable with. And, you know, recently, due to that meltdown, the government has cut the interest rates artificially to zero and kept it there for a long period of time. And that's done a couple of things. That's really shifted the benefit to borrowers and at the detriment of savers. So a saver can earn zero in a bank account today. And a borrower can go out and borrow money for very, very, very little money. So that policy has really encouraged people to say, hey, go take risk, because that's what the policy is saying. It's saying go take risk. And if you've been in the market, then you've been rewarded over the past, 5 or 6 years. But that personal risk index is something that you need to get comfortable with over a period of time.
We're talking with Tom Scantlin, who's a financial advisor at Raymond James. We're talking about how we retire today, and we want to hear your questions at 860-275-7266 if you're about ready to retire, if you have already retired, if you had your savings wiped out in 2008, or if you just started to save and you're looking forward to a long career before you retire. Call us at 860-275-7266. I want to get up on the phone here, Betty Marafino, who's president of the Connecticut Alliance for Retired Americans. She joins us to talk a bit about this. And Betty, first of all, welcome to our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to be talking about the MyRA plan and some of these other ideas that are coming out of the federal and state government in just a moment. But first of all, tell us your story. Why are you so interested and in involved in this issue?
Well, the Connecticut Alliance for Retired Americans, and we number about 50,000 retirees in the state of Connecticut, has people from a number of unions and also from community groups. So we're very interested, and even though we've retired, we speak to a lot of other people, as people like in nursing homes or senior centers, who tell us that pretty much they're living on their Social Security, which for many of them is barely at the poverty line, and that they wish that they had had some retirement savings plan to keep them going in the future so they aren't in as much poverty as they are right now. So I think the new proposal, the Senate Bill 249, an act promoting retirement savings that's right now going through our legislative process, is a very good way for people to save some money.
And we're going to be talking about that bill in just a little bit in more detail. Why do you think people need so much help saving, Betty? It seems as though it's the sort of thing that we're all told early on. Is it just about people's incomes over time? Is it about people's unwillingness to face the future? What do you think it is?
I really don't know. It's probably a number of things, but I think people need to have some options. And one of the options is to talk to people about saving, even though it's not a lot, but a little at a time. In fact, old enough to remember when I was younger and working, I belonged to a Christmas club, which just with the bank just saved some money, and it was a limited amount of money that was there when I wanted to buy Christmas presents. And I think getting something like that in the minds of people, because the bill 249 is really a savings plan. It's not a pension plan, but it's, I think, when people are working in a group in their workplace and they get together and they talk, I think they'd be more apt to save the money.
Let's go to the phones, 860-275-7266. We've got Suzanne in Milford. Hi, Suzanne. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for this. This is so timely for me in an unfortunate way, but I wanted to make a recommendation to people who might be listening, especially aging folks who are retiring and may need to turn back to their children to help to support them or other family members, that they need to have a sense of trust and maybe get prepared to give up some of that control of being, you know, their home as their domain. And it's a struggle, but people need to come to that with an open mind and a sense of harmony. And I think that there are elderly folks who feel that maybe their children are, they kind of lose a sense of trust, and I've experienced it over and over working with people at this age group, but also on a personal level. So I'm asking people to get prepared, because there needs to be that sense of cooperation and to move forward. And, you know, they can have a great quality of life if they embrace it in that way.
You know, Suzanne, before I let you go, one thing that's very important, though, is not everyone has family to fall back on.
True.
For those who have family to fall back on, there are issues of trust and whether or not you can work with your kids in order to make sure that retirement works for you. But for a lot of people, and I'm sure many you've seen, they can't really rely on family at all.
No, you're right. And I've had conversations with friends of mine of how we would have almost communal living in a way, where, you know, how would we work that together? And I think being aware that this is coming down, you know, in people's future and preparing for it, not only financially, but also psychologically and emotionally, is something that people need to think about.
Suzanne, thank you so much for that.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Betty, those sorts of ideas that Suzanne's talking about there, I'm sure that you're hearing from a lot of people who are either retirement age or just about to get there, who are considering a lot of different ideas as far as how they're going to retire, maybe different than the traditional retirement that you've experienced.
Yes, and Suzanne just said something I think that is very important. She mentioned not only financial, but psychologically and emotionally. And, you know, I was a state employee. I taught at Tunxus Community College for many years. And so it's a comfort to me now that I'm retired that I have some savings. I have something I can, you know, count on with my state pension. But I talk to so many people who don't, and a lot of them are always worried about where they're going to get their money. They're very, very worried about it when they just have Social Security and nothing else. And so you want to eliminate that worry and the emotional cost that takes on a lot of people.
And, of course, emotion is a big part of it. Let's get to one more quick phone call before our break. Paula is in New Britain. Hello, Paula.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
After going through a difficult divorce about 4 years ago, found out I had nothing because my ex was a gambler. So I had to start 4 years ago with zero, the goose egg. So I'm working very hard to pay off my home, which they tell me is now 4.5 years away. So basically I'm taking what I earn and just throwing it on the mortgage. I do have what's left of my pension, and that will be a 25-year pension. I do have a 403B non-matching because I have a pension, and that I only got started like 3 years ago. So I want to know, how am I doing? Oh, by the way, I turned 61 last week, and I just want to know in the realm of things, how am I doing? I mean, I cannot retire unless my mortgage is paid for in full.
Well, Paul, what I'm going to do is, first of all, happy birthday to you, and thank you for your question. I'm going to put you on hold so you can listen. Tom Scanlon, it's like asking a doctor to give a diagnosis over the air, but you hear her basic idea. She wonders, how is she doing given the facts that she's laid out there? What do you say?
Certainly, it's difficult to give an answer with such a short fact pattern, but frankly, I think she's doing great. And it's inferred or implied that she can't retire without having paid off that mortgage. And, you know, we didn't have enough facts there, but clearly she's a very determined individual to get to where she wants to go to. So kudos to her. And if she keeps on trucking on and paying down that debt, it sounds like she will be in a good place. And you heard her say she literally came from zero, zippo. Goose egg, nada, nothing.
And what she's doing, though, and just to be clear, she's throwing that money to try to get this house paid off because
right.
that mortgage payment is one of the biggest bills people have.
Correct.
You're essentially saying, get rid of that debt, especially in the short term, and that's going to help you retire.
Yeah, fair enough. She has a very clear plan. Somebody else, you might want to look at the interest rate being charged by the mortgage. You know, what is that interest rate? Okay, clearly, if you have a high rate, you want to pay that down. If you had a lower rate and you had more time, you might want to think about not paying that down. But she's crystal clear as to what she wants to do, and kudos to her.
We've got a lot of people who want to ask questions and join our conversation. We want to get to a few more guests as well to talk about some new plans coming from the state, perhaps, and also from the federal government to help you save for retirement. We're talking with Tom Scanlon from Raymond James. We also have on the line Betty Marafino, who's president of the Connecticut Alliance for Retired Americans. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266, where we live, right after this break. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. One-third of Connecticut residents are baby boomers, a big demographic that's headed straight toward retirement. In fact, Connecticut's population of 65-plus is growing 10 times faster than the general population. We're talking with experts about how the state and federal government are preparing for this coming surge of retirees and what you can do to prepare yourself. We'll get some more of your phone calls in a moment. During his State of the Union, President Obama touted a new proposal, retirement starter savings account. It's called MyRA.
Today, most workers don't have a pension. A Social Security check often isn't enough on its own. And while the stock market has doubled over the last 5 years, that doesn't help folks who don't have 401ks. That's why tomorrow I will direct the Treasury to create a new way for working Americans to start their own retirement savings. MyRA. It's a new savings bond that encourages folks to build a nest egg. MyRA guarantees a decent return with no risk of losing what you put in. And if this Congress wants to help, work with me to fix an upside-down tax code that gives big tax breaks to help the wealthy save, but does little or nothing for middle-class Americans.
That's President Obama from his State of the Union address. It's even hard for him to say my RA, but that's what it's called. Connecticut's also jumping on the bandwagon with their own proposed state-run retirement program. Joining us to outline this proposal at the state level and talk about also this federal plan is Julia Evans Starr, who's Executive Director of the Connecticut Commission on Aging. Hi there, Julia. Thanks for coming in.
Hi. It's good to be here.
So first of all, can you just explain what exactly the president has put out there and how it is different or similar from what Connecticut is proposing?
Well, first of all, I think it's wonderful that we're having this discussion here today, but on a national level as well. In Connecticut and across the nation, folks are really struggling with their retirement, right? We know that they used to rely on Social Security, retirement savings plans, and their own savings. And we've seen definitely from the retirement savings plan a major decrease in the ability to be able to access those. So what we're really hoping to help is low-income private sector workers, who folks who are making maybe between $30,000 and $60,000. This is with Connecticut's proposal. It's Senate Bill 249. And we're hoping to help those people be able to use their own money to save for their retirement. And these are folks who are at a great disadvantage in that I would say the vast majority of them don't have access to these retirement savings plans provided through their employer. So it's a wonderful opportunity. We're grateful that the president has put forward this initiative, but it's just a step. For example, these plans are predicated on the employees themselves contributing a piece of their salary through contributions they make. With the president's plan, MyRA, you're only able to save $15,000. So how Connecticut's plan differs.
And that's not a year.
That's total. And so once you accumulate $15,000 through your set-aside savings, that money then rolls over into a private account. Where Connecticut differs is they want to be in this for the long haul. The trust fund that they envision setting up would be administered through the state treasurer's office. It would be designed by a trust fund board of 11. It would allow for the individual, again, the target audience is for those employees who are low income and make $30,000 to $60,000, and they would in turn give a piece of their salary through auto enrollment, and the state would manage that money. It would be professionally managed. It would have a guaranteed return, which makes it unique. It would have very low risk, and it would have cost caps.
When you talk about a guaranteed return, what kind of guaranteed return? That's what I was talking with Tom Scanlon about before. You know, we have different ways of saving money, and if you get into or if you got into some more aggressive mutual funds several years ago, you could be making quite a bit of money with your money each year, or you could lose an awful lot of it in the stock market. When you say guarantees, what are these guarantees like?
So these are all questions that need to be worked out through market research analysis that's going to be overseen through this trust fund board. And so that hasn't been established, but the guaranteed return rate will be established on an annual basis through this board. And so we don't know what that looks like at this point.
Tom, what do you see just off the top of your head here about a program like this? Do you think that something like this can help?
Yeah, good question. Before I tackle that, I just want to give a quick shout out to a couple of your loyal listeners, Tim and Patches, down at Mike's Golf Outlet. So
I hope that they've saved for their retirement.
Well, they're working on it.
Okay, good.
They're working on it, believe me. So I'm not sure that this, you know, I have difficulty enunciating it too, MyRA, and then the Connecticut plan on top of that, really tools that we need. I think if you looked at the demographics that you're referencing of folks that are earning $30,000 to $60,000, something in that band every year, there is a tool out there now called a Roth IRA, which is not tax deductible. And so for someone in a $30,000 to $60,000 bracket, it's not a big deal. It's not tax deductible. The problem is once you say not deductible to anybody, their eyes glaze over and they totally tune out because people just want to know about tax deductions and tax deferral. That's all they want to know about. But a Roth IRA, if you have earned income from working, you're eligible. You can put away $5,500 per year. Now, I understand part of this is really the mechanics of how do I get the money out of my paycheck and into an investment vehicle.
Yes.
And so that's that's an issue, and that's a fair comment. Yeah, that's a fair comment. If you looked at the large mutual fund companies, the household names you'd all be familiar with, they probably have minimums of something like $2,500 or $3,000, and that might be a challenge for folks to get to that. But if you hunted around, you could find people that accept smaller minimums, and then you send the money in or have the money withdrawn every month. And here's the nice thing about this.
Yeah.
If this account is open for 5 years and you're over age 59 and a half, then when all that money comes out, it's all tax-free. Not tax-deferred. It's all tax-free.
And this is the Roth IRA.
The Roth IRA.
Taxed on the front end, not taxed on the back end. And it's just really a matter, as you say, about making sure you're able to get that money into your retirement, which is another one of the barriers that people have.
Again, if you just looked at the surface level, you'd say that's a big barrier.
Yeah.
$3,500, $2,500, that's a big barrier. But if you drill down and look under the hood, you'll find people that will take this online. You'll find smaller minimums. Or alternatively, you set up your own payroll deduction. You save $50 a week, $25 a week. You put it away, and then you have $1,000, and then you go open your Roth IRA.
Hmm. Julie, what do you think of this? Because there are other vehicles out there. I mean, why does this new plan coming from the state government potentially serve people better than vehicles that are out there already?
It's not that these other vehicles won't continue to be viable and these folks won't utilize them. But presently, you know, you asked the question earlier on the show, what's the availability from the employer's perspective of providing these retirement plans? And from the last 10 years, we've seen the availability of those plans being offered through your employer decrease by 10%. So that's very significant. And the folks that we're talking to reach are far less likely to be able to access those plans that are available, even if they are available.
Betty Marafino, I've still got you on the line, president of the Connecticut Alliance for Retired Americans. I know you wanted to talk about this proposed legislation in Connecticut. What do you think?
Yeah, well, first, you know, I'm someone who strongly believes that pensions are vital to providing a secure retirement. But, you know, this is really a savings plan. And as Julie outlined it, I think the people we're trying to reach, this would be a very viable option for them because they would merely be checking a box similar to what people do to check they want deduction for United Way. This would make it a lot easier for them. And I think they'd be more apt to do this when they're in a work environment and they're working with people, and they're more apt to save their money this way. And I think the word save for them, that's a key thing, that it's a savings plan.
Just getting people saving.
Yeah, Betty's absolutely right. I mean, I think the unique feature of what the state is hoping to accomplish with Senate Bill 249 and this trust fund is that people are automatically enrolled. You have to opt out. So research would show that participation, when you have the contribution and you have automatic enrollment, your willingness to participate really skyrockets.
Tom, quickly?
Agreed. Auto enrollment is actually a very, very key thing. And I don't have the stats in front of me, but I think in the UK, you're an organ donor unless you opt out. And in domestically, you're not an organ donor unless you opt in.
Unless you opt in.
And so in UK, I think it's 80% of people are organ donors. In domestic, I think it's 20. Mm-hmm. So that auto-enroll feature is a good feature. I would concur on that.
You can join us at 860-275-7266 as we talk about how we're retiring today. Letitia is calling from Hartford. Hi there, Letitia. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. I have a question / comment, and it's in two parts.
Yeah.
So I think that this conversation obviously is a very important one, but I also think that we're making a lot of assumptions about the people who actually really need to hear this conversation. I'm coming from the perspective of someone who grew up in the inner city, not from Hartford, but someone who definitely grew up in the inner city, and understand the fact that people who live in urban areas who are primarily minorities and taken for granted, I'm generally speaking, you know, we're not taught to save. We're not taught about money in the household. We're taught to consume. And I think that it's important to have that conversation. I know that we ask a lot of our educators and our school systems, but I think that it's important to educate our young people, again, emphasis on the inner city youth, about the importance of saving and about the importance of saving for retirement, because we're taught to live in the now, in the immediate, and we're not thinking, we're not even thinking about whether we're going to live to be age 59 and a half. And then second part of that is I heard the range of $30,000 to $60,000 a year. What about the people who live at or below the poverty level? I think that perhaps there should be some sort of a model where as though people who are living at or below the poverty level have knowledge and information about savings, and maybe perhaps, you know, I understand that President Obama has that RA plan, but what about a portion being saved from people who receive that earned income credit, or a portion being saved or set aside for people when they receive that tax return if they don't have a set aside for savings? I just think that these are important considerations. And again, just for emphasis, for people who are from, who make below that $30,000 a year, or people who from the inner city, maybe that group, I don't remember the name of the group, where you have people who are already retired who have these conversations with people who say that they wish they had a retirement. Maybe they can go into the classrooms and educate our young people about the importance of saving for retirement. That's all I wanted to say. I'll take my call off the air.
Well, Leticia, first of all, it's a great phone call. I very much appreciate it. And I think she raises two things that I wanted to talk about. One has to do with education, almost as much as providing any sort of a vehicle for people to save. It's actually talking with people, Julia, about retirement. This is very important. I also say, we had a recent NPR story about this, about how Latinos in America are living longer than any other ethnic group, but saving less. Yeah. This is something that's very, very important. There are a number of groups in America that haven't, for whatever reason, traditionally been able to think about retirement the same way. So Leticia's saying education's a big piece of this.
It is a big piece of it. And so this one proposal with Senate Bill 249, it isn't the panacea. It's a great beginning and a great product. And I hope that it's successful throughout this session and moving forward being implemented. But it couldn't have been more eloquent than the caller. I mean, education is key. And, you know, when we talk about this issue, we're talking primarily, you hear people talk about the present generation of older adults. But that's really not who we're talking about here. I mean, we are in the context of being empathetic and trying to help them with their present quality of life. But when you're going to make significant change and educate people, you need to start when they're young. And I think that's an excellent point she raises. And we need to have family conversations about finances. It's uncomfortable for many people, but we need to do some planning. So I think it was an excellent call, and I couldn't agree more.
Now, when we come back, we're going to take more of your phone calls about retirement at 860-275-7266. We're also going to bring into the conversation Jacob Hacker from Yale University. He's been writing about not just Connecticut's, but also Americans' financial situation for a number of years. We're going to put this retirement question to him, and we're going to get some of your questions as well. 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow. Earlier this year, the world watched as civil unrest erupted in the streets of Venezuela. Since then, violent anti-government protests have claimed 39 lives and haven't shown signs of stopping. On our program tomorrow, we'll get an update on the situation in Venezuela. We'll also look at how cyber terrorism has become a growing threat to international security. You can join us on the next Where We Live and always online at WNPR.org.
Are you saving money for retirement?
Oh, hell no.
Being 24, I do not. I mean, I think about it, and I think I should be worried about it. As I am working in a restaurant, I do not have, you know, 401k. It's a mom and pop restaurant. It's not a big corporate chain where they have, you know, stock options and retirement options for you. So besides, you know, just a general thought, I don't do anything to prepare for retirement.
I was driving home on NPR last night. They said that retirement is bad, which I've always thought too. In fact, I yanked my father-in-law straight out of retirement, and his brain has been much better ever since. My mother-in-law too. She really wanted to retire. If she'd retired 10 years ago, she'd be senile right now. But she is chugging away. She's a beautiful person with a beautiful mind.
Those are some voices gathered by Anna Novak talking about retirement. And we're talking about how we retire today. Maybe we'll talk about some of the emotional and psychological benefits or not of retirement coming up in just a little bit. That first voice you heard, the person who said, oh, hell no, I'm not saving for retirement. Well, that's a lot of Americans. Many Americans have hardly anything saved. That's what we're talking about today with Julia Evans Starr, who's executive director of the Connecticut Commission on Aging. We're also joined in the studio by Tom Scanlon, who's a financial advisor at Raymond James. We're going to get a few more more phone calls at 860-275-7266 in just a moment. But I want to welcome back Jacob Hacker, who's professor of political science, director of Institution for Social and Policy Studies at Yale University, and author of The Great Risk Shift, The Assault on American Jobs, Families, Healthcare, and Retirement, and How You Can Fight Back. Jacob, always good to talk to you on Where We Live.
Well, thank you for having me on, John.
So you've been listening to some of this conversation. What strikes you about how Americans are retiring today?
Well, I think the first thing I would say, and it's come up before, is that what Americans are experiencing today is very different from what we're going to see in the future. You know, the current generation of retirees are really living in the golden age of retirement, the system that was built up during the mid-20th century that included defined benefit pensions, guaranteed pensions from your employer, as well as Social Security and private savings. That three-legged stool, if you will, of private pensions from your employer, a Social Security benefit, and then your own savings and housing, that three-legged stool is shifted over to what I call a two-legged stool. You're basically you're relying on Social Security on the one leg and your private savings, whether that's inside a 401k or outside it, on the other leg. And the result is that, as Tom has said repeatedly, much more risk and responsibility has been shifted from the broad shoulders of government and corporations onto the backs of American workers and their families.
So with that risk shift, and it doesn't seem anytime soon like that's going to change, how do you see, Jacob, Americans coping right now? I mean, do we need something like President Obama's MyRA plan? Do we need the state to incentivize, actually ask you to opt out of some sort of retirement savings? What's the best way to deal with this?
Well, do we need a response? The answer is absolutely we do. We have the highest levels of public concern about retirement savings that we've seen at least in a generation. We know from some of the major measures of retirement risk that, especially in the wake of the Great Recession, that many Americans are inadequately prepared for retirement. And above all, we know that we have to do something to shore up Social Security and ensure that people have some forms of savings that are guaranteed outside of Social Security. So I would just say that the really important thing to understand is that traditional guaranteed pensions, they did a lot of things, but what they did above all was really require that people save. After all, it was your employer who basically paid you a little bit less in wages and put money in a retirement plan. So any solution that is going to work is going to have to very strongly encourage, if not require, that individuals save on top of Social Security. I would just add one other thing that has come up a little less than it should, and Letitia's call brings it to mind, that the current system is not only not allowing people to save enough for retirement or encouraging them to save enough for retirement, it's also providing the greatest benefits for savings to the most affluent Americans. The figures are really stunning. About 70% of all 401k and other defined contribution pension savings is held by the top fifth of Americans. And that's partly because the tax breaks are so generous for higher income Americans, but much less so for lower and middle income Americans.
We're talking with Jacob Hacker from Yale University, and we'll take some phone calls now from you at 860-275-7266. Nina's in Milford. Hi, Nina.
Hi. How are you? My question was actually just around the idea of today, our culture being so different, very consumer-oriented, and how do we deal with that given the fact that the notion of saving, I think generationally, while there were problems before 50 years ago, I think young people, especially today, their assumption is that they should just go out and spend, literally. And that's what the society tells them to do.
Well, Nina, first of all, thank you very much. Jacob Hacker, what do you think about that? We've turned into such a consumer society. The idea of saving doesn't make a whole lot of sense when we're also told, well, spending is very, very good for the economy. Plus, we've got all that stuff that we want to buy. What do you say to Nina?
Well, I think that always the temptation is to spend what you earn. And that's why traditional retirement plans and Social Security essentially require that you contribute money before you even get it into your paycheck. And that's really something that we've discovered from the last generation of research on what's called behavioral economics that shows that people just have a very hard time making those decisions that will allow them to retire comfortably in the future, and they need help. And while we can lament this reality, and I think it's a longstanding reality. I don't think that these temptations just suddenly cropped up in the last 10 or 15 years. We really have to make sure that we structure retirement savings options in a way that best encourages people to put aside adequate amounts for retirement.
But, Julie, it seems in many ways like we just had this conversation, though. We're talking about saying, you know, you need to save something. As a matter of fact, we're going to make you save something of your own into an individual retirement account. We just got through a big battle saying you have to have health insurance and you have to buy it through one of these carriers that we're going to set up on an exchange. It seems as though we're having yet another conversation with Americans about how you have to do something. We're not really going to help you all that much, but we're going to tell you that you have to do something. Do you think that, Julie, is one of the barriers for people to maybe a plan like the one that you're talking about here in Connecticut?
I think that might be the perception, and I think perceptions often cause barriers when you're trying to promote smart and innovative public policy. To the part that the folks we want to help are 700,000 people in Connecticut who don't have access to retirement saving plan through their employer. That is staggering. When we had the discussion on the minimum wage, that was potentially going to impact some 70 to 9,000 people. This is 10 times that amount. These are folks that we're not suggesting that you have to. You talk about education. When you get a job, I mean, if there's any responsibility on the employer, it's to give them a piece of paper or packet to say, this is part of your benefits. And you can opt out or you can utilize it. So I don't feel like it's a harsh mandate. I think it's more of an opportunity, and I hope that's the spirit of the plan that's being put forward and the dialogue moving forward.
Well, Jacob, what do you think about this? I mean, from a political science standpoint, this is a very big question, though. The more we tell people, you have to do this, you have to do this, the government is going to mandate in one way that you have to save or that you have to get health insurance. It's all about that risk shift that you wrote about back in 2006, in which, you know, we used to have a covenant with our employers or with the federal government to take care of us. Now it's really more and more on us.
But it's always been a two-way street. I mean, as I said, employers did not provide pensions, guaranteed pensions, out of the goodness of their heart. They did so because it was conducive to having workers stay with their employer for a long period of time. And they actually reduced the amount of pay that workers received so that they would be putting aside money for those workers' retirement. What's happened over the last generation is that employers no longer see much benefit, at least employers of the vast majority of Americans, they don't see much benefit in pooling the risk in retirement, the market risk, the risk that you'll outlive your savings, the risk that you will retire at a time of high inflation, and so on. Those kinds of risks, which are hard for individuals to prepare against, used to be pooled by employers and the federal government acting together, and now they're only really pooled by the federal government. So one of the things that I think gets missed in this discussion is that a lot of these plans are actually about allowing reclaiming some of this pooled risk through various measures, whether it's some kind of guaranteed rate of return, whether it's spreading the benefits over time like an annuity so that you receive a fixed benefit per month for the remainder of your life, even if you live longer than expected, or whether it's because you're shifting money across generations to compensate for the fact that sometimes you have large shifts in the stock market or large shifts in the employment market. And that's something that only government can do. It doesn't have to directly provide it, but that kind of risk pooling, if it's not done by employers, will have to be done by government. But it can be done in a way where it's not costly to taxpayers, where it's really helping people do something that they need to do already. And as was discussed, it's really a question of shifting the default from not saving for retirement to saving a little bit each month for retirement. And if people are required to opt out rather than to opt in, we know that many people will just continue to do this because essentially that money is never seen. It's not in their paycheck, but they know that they're being more secure for retirement. And I think this is actually something that Americans would welcome. But of course, it's going to have that politically controversial element, as do all proposals that involve government.
Of course. And we're getting some tweets and phone callers who want to talk about something else, which is probably too big a conversation, about the high cost of a college education. When you have a very, very expensive student loan to pay off, it's a lot harder to put away that $100 or $200 each month.
Well, John, that's absolutely right. I mean, we're talking about an era in which middle-class wages have stagnated, and yet the cost of some of these vital goods like education and healthcare have gone up. And that's part of the reason that retirement savings is so much more difficult.
Let's go to Yvette in Plainville. Hi, Yvette. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, thank you for taking my call and excellent discussion this morning.
Thank you.
What I wanted to know is for the last couple of years, I've been unemployed. However, I did save in all of those different vehicles over the years. But now I find myself taking out of the money that I've been saving for retirement. And at 54 this year, I'm wondering how that would affect. And I do like the 429 program. So when I get another position, I'll be adding into that as well. So, how does someone hang on to what they have put away?
Yvette, first of all, great question. Tom, quickly, people, you know, taking money out of their retirement to pay for the right now. What do you say?
Generally speaking, if you take a distribution before age 59 and a half, you're subject to, first of all, the income tax on that, and second of all, a 10% premature penalty. There are some limited exceptions to that. If you're unemployed, if you had to pay for health care, first-time home buyer, but there's a very limited exceptions, and that those exceptions are just for the penalty, not for the income tax.
And Julia, this is exactly what we don't want people doing, though. We don't want people having to tap in during a hard time to the retirement that they've built up, because it will be taxed and it will penalize them. It also will mean less money to retire on later.
That's right. And what we know is people, you know, who are 54, 64, 70, they don't want to rely on their families. They want to have the dignity and the independence to be able to use their own money to care for whatever their needs and to enjoy their retirement. One point I wanted to make, John,
sure,
in your previous question, and I didn't want it to get lost, is Senate Bill 249 isn't an instrument of state government. It'll be at no cost to state government. The contributions an employee makes will pay for the administrative costs, which will be 1% or less. So I wanted to make that point where it feels like government. Government is really just the facilitator.
The government's the facilitator of this. We have time for maybe one more phone call here quickly from Scott in Hartford. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hey, John. I just want to follow up on some of the comments that were made earlier in the program and where I think, you know, a possible solution could be. You had someone call in earlier talking about they worked for a restaurant and they didn't really they weren't saving for retirement.
Yeah.
You talked about the mandatory, health care provisions. Australia has, I think, what we're looking for, or at least some version of it, is that employers have to put in 9.25% into a retirement account for everyone working 18 to 70. It's mandatory. It's very restrictive. You can't take that money out. So it seems like, and it's immensely popular and very highly rated compared worldwide with other pension plans.
Jacob, I don't know, and thank you, Scott. I don't know anything about the Australian model, but is this the sort of thing that makes sense?
Well, Australia isn't the only country. I mean, there are a number of countries that have moved towards what is sometimes called notional accounts, where there are contributions made, and your returns depend in part on the returns of the market, and they depend in part on wage growth, and they depend in part on the length of life of your cohort. And I just want to come back to something that I think is really linked to this, which is, yes, many of these plans would be at no cost to the government, but one thing that the government can do is pool risk. And so by sponsoring these plans, it's pooling risk. And this risk that most Americans face today is this risk of outliving their savings. And so it's really important that not only people be strongly encouraged to save, but there also be ways in which they can essentially insure themselves against this risk. But even as we're aware that people are sometimes outliving their savings, we sometimes forget that there's a big inequality in the amount of time that people live after retirement. And low-income Americans have not seen the big increase in life expectancy. So whenever we debate raising the retirement age or moving back the time that people retire, we should keep in mind that it's more affluent Americans who have mostly experienced this increase in their life expectancy after retirement. So we need to balance these considerations. My own view is that we should be moving towards a system that does link retirement age to the life expectancy of people who are retiring, but that does so that doesn't penalize those workers who have not seen a big increase in life expectancy.
And that gets to maybe in another entire hour we can do about how long people are living and how long they're working, something else that we can definitely talk about in a future show. Jacob Hacker, professor of political science at Yale University. His book is The Great Risk Shift. Jacob, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Always good. Thanks.
Thanks also to Tom Scanlon, who is the financial advisor at Raymond James. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Thanks to Julia Evans Starr, executive director of the Connecticut Commission on Aging. Thank you for coming in.
Good to be here.
Thanks to our intern, Skylar Magnoli, for her help on today's program. This is Where We Live.